The Pre-Mid Year, session number 576. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Mid Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Now, welcome to The Pre-Mid Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have an awesome guest, Noor, a fantastic instructor from Blueprint MCAT, who is on her own journey to medical school and in medical school. And we're going to talk all about her journey, her success with the MCAT, and all of that stuff, including being the daughter of physicians. And what does that look like? Let's go ahead and say hello to Noor. Noor, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dr. Gray. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm excited to chat with you. We've talked many times on the MCAT podcast, but this is your first time, I think, here on the pre-med years podcast. So it'll be a fun conversation about you and your journey to medical school. So let's start with when you first realized you wanted to be a doctor.
Oh, man. I think it's always been something like I've thought about in the background. My parents are both physicians, so I grew up with medicine. It wasn't something that was unfamiliar for me. Actually, it's funny because my first job that I ever wanted to have as a kid, this is so cheesy, was a librarian because I really liked reading books. And I'm like, I want to be around books all the time. So very cheesy. But I think as I grew older and I started enjoying the sciences more, especially like biology was something that I was good at. It became more and more of something that I realized I wanted to do. I don't think I've ever had like a moment where I was like, oh my God, I want to be a physician. You know, like some people talk about that life-changing moment. But it's something that I've reflected over time a lot, especially when I was in college and then through my years of like postgraduate, like study and work. So, and just kind of like, you know, the kind of role that I want to play in the world. So,
How you mentioned your parents are physicians. How much of them being physicians do you think hurt or hindered? And those are both the same one. hindered or helped your pre-med journey?
I think so. My parents both got their medical education in Iraq, so they didn't get it here. And my mom actually wasn't able to like work here, but she did work before we came to the States. And so I think for me, like I always knew the reality of how intense medicine was. Like it wasn't like I saw my dad go through it here. He had to redo residency at 40 when he came here. And I've seen how intense it is. And so I think there was no like romanticization of like, oh my God, like, you know, this is intense. No, it's intense. It's a lot of work. And so I think I was very grateful to get that real like point of view. And I wouldn't say maybe it hindered as much as it made me think very deeply about the sacrifice and the commitment to it. So, you know, having made this decision, like I'm very much aware of like the sacrifices you have to make. So I really do appreciate that, you know, sort of reality check that I always got about what it takes to become a physician.
Did they ever try to dissuade you?
No, I think it was sometimes my dad would be like, I don't know if you want to do this. but I think it was always kind of just like, you know, just be aware of the responsibility of how intense the journey is. And if that is what you want to do. So it was always like, just make sure that you think about it very deeply. And I appreciate that because it is something that I think is really, really important for everyone to do.
Yeah. You mentioned some postgraduate work. Why did you need to do postgraduate work?
So when I was an undergrad, I think I realized like within my first quarter, I was at UCLA, that I did not want to go into medicine right away. And I think it's because I was like, you know, there's so much to learn. There's so much to do. And I'm an interdisciplinary person. Like I love the sciences, but I also love the humanities. And for me, I felt like I wasn't ready for that responsibility yet. I think medicine is such an intense responsibility, even being in medical school. There is a lot of responsibility that comes with that. I keep saying the same word, but like the knowledge that you have to learn, the skills that you have to become better at. And for me, I also developed a love for global health when I was in undergrad. And I think for me, I was like, you know, I really want to explore like what that looks like education-wise and working within the field of global health research. And maybe my role isn't as a physician, right? Like maybe it's something else, right? There's so many noble careers and the sciences and public health. I mean, there's just so many different positions you can do nowadays, really. Like it's really, really expansive. I think once upon a time it was like physician and nothing else, right? But now it's like you can play so many different roles in public health, global health. And so for me, I was like, you know, I don't feel ready for this journey yet. And I want to explore this interest that I have. That maybe if I don't, I might have regrets or I might be like, but why didn't I explore that? So,
What were you thinking, feeling, pondering when you came to that conclusion of like, I'm not really ready yet? Because I think a lot of students in a similar situation may have some feelings. They're like, I don't know what this feeling is, but I'm supposed to be a doctor, so I'm just going to go for it. When really that potential feeling is, let me go explore some other places.
Yeah. So for me, like I, again, like really got into public health, global health. And I think it's because like, you know, when you're in that field, you're always pushed to think more about, you know, what are the social determinants of health? And to me, I was like, wow, like this has a lot of basis in equity and social justice and equity. And I was like, this is really great. Like, this is something that I really want to explore. And some people might, I went and I got my master's of science in global health from Harvard. Some people might go and get more education, which is totally great. Some people might be like, you know what? I just really want to go work. I want to stop doing so much school and I want to go in and do work, but it really could be anything. I mean, I have talk to people that run the gambit of stuff that they've done in the years before medical school. You know, one of my really good friends here, he worked on, you know, in the city of Boston with social services on the, like how to advocate for the homeless population in Boston. And it was something that, you know, he didn't get another degree. He just did that work for years, right? And so I think I always tell people, if you have the feeling of not being ready just yet, I really want you to lean into that because that is like, there is good intuition that's telling you like, maybe there is more for me to explore. Maybe there's more for me to, you know, check out in the world. And maybe you end up going on a different path and that's totally okay. Or maybe you might come back to medicine and you'll come back stronger and more informed and have a lot more real life experience.
Yeah. Newton's whatever law it is, first or second or whatever, the object in motion will stay in motion. Like once you start medical school, that ball is rolling, right? It's really hard to explore once you've started medical school because the debt's starting to accumulate. If you don't go straight from medical school into residency, usually there kind of historically are issues with getting a residency then. And then once you're a resident, you got to finish that. And then once there, it's like, now you need to go get an attending job because these loans are adding up. And so, as you mentioned, right, if you have a little bit of a feeling, go explore. Now is the perfect time before you jump into that medical education world because it's really hard to stop once you're in there to smell the roses, as they say.
You're not smelling any roses anymore. You're just hand sanitizer.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, okay. So you went and explored. What was it then as you're out exploring that kind of said, I do want to go to medical school versus staying in the public health world, maybe going and joining an NGO somewhere across the world?
Yeah. So for me, I've always wanted to get, you know, in the overachiever realm, of course, like another terminal degree. So I got my master's for 2 years, which is a research-based degree. And I went ahead and worked in many different global health research projects. And the idea was, you know, I want to go back and ultimately get another degree, but I wasn't sure if it would be an MD or a PhD or maybe an MD PhD. I had that thought for like 2 days. And then I was like, no, I can't do this any more years. And so then for me, as I was working in different global health research projects, I worked with a lot of physicians who were both physicians and global health researchers or public health researchers that worked domestically within the states. And so I did see like sort of their dual lives of both being a physician and being researchers. And I realized over time, like with my different roles, that as much as I appreciated the research, I always felt like there was a like something lacking in terms of making viable change in the moment. And how much I enjoyed like one-on-one interaction with patients or people that were participating in our research. And so I think, you know, I thought to myself, again, research plays a very important role in all aspects of our lives, but yeah. It wasn't something that I could see myself doing just like full-time, long-term. And so I think I started going back to this idea of what it looks like to have tangible change. So, you know, I'm still someone who's really invested on large scale change and working in global health. Mm-hmm. But now being in this position of learning clinical care, it definitely feels more in my element and very reassuring that I feel like this is the kind of tangible change that I want to do on a daily basis. And yeah. So it went through a lot of reflection on all the different types of experiences that I had and ultimately realizing, yeah, I think this is the right direction of where to go. And so, yeah.
I read lots of personal statements, and there are lots of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed pre-med students who want to change the world, and fantastic, right? We need that sort of moxie, if you want to call it that. Bring back an old word. I was watching Night at the Museum with my kids. I think Amelia Earhart in the second movie uses that word. I'm like, where'd that word come from? But anyway, when I read that, I often will have kind of initial reaction to go, well, like, you can probably have a much bigger impact on public health, on the medical infrastructure and healthcare outside of being a physician, right? Because once you're a physician, like, you're kind of stuck. You got to see patients to make money. That's just kind of how that works.
Yeah.
How do you feel like, as you've kind of seen both sides, obviously still a medical student at this point, but having that experience, learning about the public health stuff and wanting a bigger impact, how do you see yourself having that impact as a physician while also knowing that kind of your salary comes from seeing patients?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, like, there's impacts on every level, right? Like, there's the impact that people make day to day by treating a patient, getting them better. And then, yeah, there are people who make incredible impact by advocating for policy changes, right? And so one of the greatest advocates for health equity are physicians, because you're the person who sees day in and day out how social determinants of health, such as unequal access to healthcare, impacts the lives of your patients. Like, you see the visceral, real life biological impact. And so I'm actually of the, you know, belief that physicians need to be more, in the sense of, like, I'm not saying you should do more, but I think, like, there is so much more room for physicians to become advocates as a whole, and to say, like, you know, I have many examples of patients who have, because of their, you know, unequal access to healthcare, they're developing these conditions that are actually easily preventable if they had healthcare access to begin with, right? And so I think, you know, we do play a very, very important role. You know, maybe we're not the researchers, we're not going to Congress all the time to advocate, we're not running the NGOs, but I believe physicians should always be tapped in, because you have the real life testimony. This isn't like a simulation. It's not a conjecture. Yeah. It's real life. And so for me, actually, I really enjoy actually being on the front lines now, because it's like, I'm speaking from personal experience, right? I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And maybe this kind of, like, not tangential, but it's funny, because maybe there was a moment in the last few years where I was like, I really want to become a physician, is when the pandemic hit. Mm. And I realized, especially in the beginning, I was like, I wish I was on the front lines helping. Like, that was actually such a, oh my God, moment for me, because so much amazing work was being done public health wise, you know, in the background by all these different amazing researchers. I actually helped out with, I was living in Massachusetts at that time. So I helped out with the contact tracing efforts, which were very, very important in controlling the spread of COVID. But I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, I really wish I was on the front lines. And also because during COVID, we saw how inequity in healthcare reared its ugly head of like who was actually end up getting access to the most life-saving procedures, as well as like who got access to the vaccine and who needed to like go back to work early and all of these things. And so I actually think like, and people are realizing this over time, that physicians play such a huge role in changing healthcare systems. Like when we speak up, when we advocate for our patients, even if it's just one patient and not an entire population, people listen to you. At the end of the day, people listen to physicians. They do, right? They're like, doctor, MD. And so that's why actually some of the most impactful people advocating for global health equity are physicians. Because people are like, well, this person has the know-how. I don't think it should be just physicians, but we do play a very, very important role. So I think it's just enhanced sort of like the role I want to play.
It's maybe at Stanford where you're at, it's part of the curriculum there. But how do you suggest medical students, pre-meds, go and get this understanding of what it is like to do advocacy work and go to local town hall meetings and meet their representatives and all that kind of stuff to enact this change that they want to see in this world?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds maybe too simple-minded, but there's so many books out there that talk about, you know, health inequities. I mean, there's one that is, I forgot the author's name, but it's a really good book called Medical Apartheid. And it just talks about how, like, in the U.S. historically, how the Black population has, like, really experienced this apartheid in the medical system. Before, it used to be very, very egregious, but now it's like more subtly egregious in different ways, such as like the Black maternal mortality rate is higher than other groups of people. So there's a lot of incredible research and books out there. There are podcasts. There are a lot of people who talk about health inequities, both physicians and public health researchers. And I always tell people like, the best thing you can do is to educate yourself. Even if you're like, I don't know where to start, like literally type into Google Scholar, like health inequities or what I just suggested, like Black maternal mortality, and you'll have hundreds of articles that come up about just health inequities. And it's part of my curriculum, yes, but I don't think there's ever a time like where we can stop learning about this. You know, like this is something that I have to constantly educate myself about. And because unfortunately these inequities continue. So there isn't a moment where I'm like, you know, I've gotten a degree in this, I've, you know, worked in it, but there's still so much that I have to learn. And unfortunately it changes and there's new inequities that pop up over time. And I think it's a physician's role or pre-med medical student physician to continue to learn about how we can better also spot these inequities, right? Yeah. Because some we can see more than others. And the more we educate them ourselves, the better physicians we are.
Yeah. So you're out of college, doing your thing, learning about public health, taking classes at Harvard. Pandemic hits and you're like, I want to be on the front lines. That's where I want to be. What were your first steps to kind of understand what you needed to do to go back to medical school? Did you need to explore post-bac work? What did you have to do next?
So for me, no post-bac work because when I was at UCLA for my undergrad, I did take all the pre-med courses. So I was lucky in that sense. I do have friends here with me first years who did have to go back and do post-bac programs. And they, you know, you can do it at, there's so many options, right? I have friends, a couple of friends who did it at Harvard Extension School, for example. So some universities have these things called extension schools like UCLA does where you could basically do a post-bac program. So many, many options out there. I personally didn't have to. I knew that I had to tackle the scariest thing of my life, which was the MCAT. That was actually really my biggest hurdle when it came to medical school because it was something that I was, and we've talked about this before, but it was something that I was really afraid of for a very long time. So I needed to through that fear. And then, well, because I was so afraid of not doing well, like I was like so terrified of not doing well and then not succeeding, because I had that toxic pre-med mentality that is really instilled in you from, you know, medical, the moment you enter, what's it called? Undergrad. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the moment you enter Reddit. I'm like, yes.
Oh gosh. Yeah, that too. No. It's funny because a few months ago, I was tabling for Blueprint at this pre-med conference happening at Stanford, and there were like freshmen in college that came up to me asking about MCAT, and I was like, please go home.
go home and change your diapers. What are you doing here?
I was like, do not do this, you know? And so it's something that is just hangs over so many pre-med teachers' heads. I see it now as an MCAT instructor.
Yeah.
So for me, I had to face the fear that I had for years about taking the MCAT and figure out how I was going to do that. And, you know, for me, ultimately deciding that, well, in addition to my therapist helping me.
Thank the Lord for therapists.
I know, I swear. And I had to decide, like, should I take a course? Should I self-study? Like, all of these things that I had to go through the motions. But really, like, the MCAT was the first step for me. And again, for others, it's different. For others, I have a friend here. He's 36 years old. He's a first-year med student. For him, like, he was a comic book cartoon artist before this. So
that's awesome. He had to be like,
I know. And he had to be like, oh, whoa, science, you know? So that was, like, post-bac programs, taking the MCAT. So for some people, it's more of a laborious process because post-bac programs are usually, what, a year and a half, 2 years? So that already adds more to your timeline of when going back to medical school. Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned exploring. Oh, by the way, Harriet Washington is the author of Medical Apartheid. The question about do I do a course, do I self-study for the MCAT is a big one. The last time I looked at available data, I don't think the AAMC asks this question anymore, but there used to be a question, maybe there still is, but I haven't seen it, about students who are entering medical school. It's the MSQ, the Matriculating Students Questionnaire, about how you prepped for the MCAT. And last I saw, it was less than 50%. It wasn't much less, but it was less than 50% of students actually did some sort of formal course. So not everyone does it. It's maybe 50-50. I don't know what the current numbers are. How did you decide what you were going to do to prep for yourself?
Yeah. So I actually tried to take the MCAT back in 2016. I took a course then, and then I ended up not taking the MCAT. So I had taken a course before when I was starting to look at courses in 2021, and I didn't really enjoy that course. You know, I didn't really think it helped me much. I will not mention any names here because I do not want to be sued. So I was actually going to go the route of like self-study.
You can't be sued for personal opinion, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's how you know I'm not a lawyer. Or I'm going to law. But if you ask me about, you know, pulmonary edema and anemia, I guess I could tell you. So that's me flexing my first year knowledge as I end my first year of med school. But, so for me, I thought in 2021, I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to self-study. You know, I didn't really like courses, but I was working full time and I was like, I have ADHD and I was like, I am not being able to organize this. Like, this feels really overwhelming. I'm not like, I don't know where to start. I was getting overwhelmed. And so I was like, okay, let me explore what courses are out there. And so when I was looking at courses, I was looking at something that was like highly organized, that could help me like give structure to my studying, something that I felt like didn't overload on the information, helped like give me so many resources as well. And then had good reviews and ratings as well. And that's, you know, I landed at Blueprint, which is interesting because in 2016, Blueprint was Next Step.
Yep.
And it wasn't a course at that time. It was just, you know, tutoring. Exams. And I remember people saying, yeah, and then tutoring. And then people were telling me, oh, the exams for Next Step are great. So I actually was looking at Next Step and apparently it was Blueprint and it had a course. So for me, the structure worked, the amount of resources worked, the reviews were good, and, you know, it's a chance. Courses are not cheap. They're expensive. Yeah. But ultimately for me, like, I don't think I had enough discipline for myself and too much of anxiety to not to try to self-study.
Yeah.
Some people do it. Some people are really good at it and they do really well on the MCAT and it just works for them. There are some instructors that I have taught with that didn't do a course. They self-studied and it just really depends on your capability and timeline too.
Yeah.
And resources as well.
Yeah.
But there, even if you don't do a course, because again, it's expensive. There are so many free resources out there, like so many. Yeah.
Like the MCAT podcast.
I also, yes, like the MCAT podcast. Blueprint also offers a lot of free resources online. So I also wouldn't fret and say, oh, you 100% have to take a course to do well. That's not true. Obviously can help, but it's not true that like you won't do well if you don't have a course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that thinking. And I think another reason I despise, lots of reasons I despise Reddit and Student Doctor Network, those threads on the MCAT subreddit on Reddit, where it's like, here's how I got a 525 only studying for 4 days, 3 hours a day. I'm like, and students flock to that going, oh, if it works for that person, it'll work for me. I'm like, we're all different. What are your resources? What is your, what are your strengths and weaknesses and how do you need to study? One of the reasons I really struggled in medical school starting off, number one, I never really had to have great study habits in undergrad to get good enough grades. Mm. So I didn't have great study habits to begin with. And then I took 3 years off between undergrad and starting medical school. And then I kind of ignored how I best learn, which is by listening, because I met my now wife very early on in med school, like the second day of orientation, and decided to just study with her and hang out with her because that's what we do as creatures. And so her method of studying did not work for me, but I didn't understand that at the time. I should have been sitting in lectures listening, whereas I just sat at home and read the books and read the notes and did all of that. So it's just understanding yourself as you go through this process is huge.
It is. I think like we have to learn how we learn and it becomes different as we age. Like right now, I realize that the best way for me to learn medicine is to be forced to enact it, utilize it. So we have, you know, we obviously have a lot of classes, but we also have these groups called clinical reasoning right now where you are given like a patient who comes in with a complaint and then you have to work through the physical exam, the lab values. And to me, that is, or when I shadow, I find myself that I learn best because I'm actually being forced, which sounds like bad, but it pushes me to use the material that I've learned and it solidifies it. And now I see it in real life and I'm like, oh, okay, now like this is something that I fully understand instead of just passive, like being spoon fed information.
Yeah.
And so you can't, you know, avoid that because that is the knowledge being introduced to you. And some people, like, they can walk away from that and they just really feel like they know it. And for me, it's like, I want to
show off.
I want to learn. No, I want to learn how to use this. How are you going to see it? You like, give me clinical vignettes so I can figure it out. And so again, we have to learn how we best learn, because I think when you give time for that and you start changing your study habits, you do much better than forcing yourself to follow someone else's learning. For example, you will never find me being able to study for like 7 hours straight. Like it will never happen. No matter how much like stimulants focus you give me, it just won't.
I was going to say, just load you up with your Adderall. I'm like, oh, that doesn't help either.
No, I think my heart would be way too fast. But it's more of like now, and I enacted this with the MCAT the second time I studied for it. I was like, okay, I'm going to study for like 2 hours and then I'm going to, I don't know, take a break, watch some TV or.
How do you not feel guilty about not studying?
Just, yeah, you know, I don't, the guilt, I don't have an answer for that right now because I still feel like I'm still struggling with the guilt of like when I'm not studying all the time for medical school. But I think over time I was like, man, I'm just a human being and I need to live. You know, I just need to live. I need to eat. I need to sleep. I need to enjoy life. Yep. And feeling this guilt, I mean, it's not going to get me anywhere. You know, it's just not. It's going to make me more miserable. And so it's something that you have to like work through. I mean, my therapist also helps tremendously. But for me, when I realized that like if I broke up my study time, I ended up being more efficient and like more positive than me like forcing myself to sit in one place for 7 to 8 hours and just like power through. Some people can do that. Others can't do it, right? Some people need to change. They need to walk around. There are people who, like, when they're studying, they just need to move around because when they move around, they can focus better because they're not going to be distracted by something else, right? And all of those types of learning, I don't care if you learn best standing up. Who cares? Like, as long as you're learning and you can enact that, that's perfect. So I think that's one thing that I think a lot of pre-meds also struggle with is, well, if that worked, like you were saying, if that worked for them, why isn't it working for me? Because you're a different human being.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
That's okay. So there are lots of students listening to this going, I know how I study. I know how I learn. I know what works for me. But I'm still struggling on the MCAT. Now, obviously, you crushed the MCAT. You're an MCAT instructor now with Blueprint MCAT.
Yeah.
How do we start to diagnose why a student is struggling if all of the things we're saying they're doing and still something's still not clicking?
Yeah. So I think with the MCAT, that is like the MCAT I felt like is its own subject to learn. So I think like the thing is, when I came to the MCAT the second time, I realized that the way that MCAT wants you to take the test is not like anything that we've learned in college, especially in our undergrad pre-med, you know, prerequisite courses. Like we are not tested in that way. The way that we're tested in those classes most often is regurgitation. Like you learn the information, now you produce it on an exam. And the MCAT is a very application-based exam. So I think a lot of people, they're like, yeah, I'm great at school. I do well. I know how to learn. But then they come to the MCAT and they're like, this is weird. This is not the same thing. Why am I struggling with this? And that's because, and I know it sounds really annoying, but you have to learn how to take the MCAT exam. And that's the thing with also, if you're looking at what courses to take, I always tell people, make sure that your course isn't necessarily just reteaching you the material. Are they teaching you how to approach questions? Are they teaching you how to identify traps and tricks? Because the MCAT loves to trick you. Like, after being an instructor now for more than a year and seeing a lot of content, like material, you realize that there's a certain number of tricks the MCAT has up its sleeve to try to push you away from like the correct answer. And so the more that you study how the MCAT is structured, how it's trying to test you, the better you get at it. So it's like, okay, a lot of times people, what they realize is like, it's not, I didn't get this wrong because I don't know the content. I got this wrong because I struggled to apply the content that I know. Or I got this wrong because there was this particular trick that the MCAT used to get me away from the correct answer. Yep. And so I don't doubt that people know the content well. I think a lot of people do. I think everybody who studies for the MCAT, I think they're hard workers. Like, you're not going to take the MCAT not being a hard worker. We all know how intense it is. But I think it's the approach to it and realizing that, wait, this is not, I am not being tested the same way that I've been tested in school before. I'm being tested on how well I can apply my knowledge. So that's why we always tell people, you have to start your practice for the MCAT, like question taking or practicing questions, even doing full length early on, because if you push it all the way towards the end, you're going to be like, oh, whoa, wait, I don't know how to approach these questions actually. So content is like only one half I think to me personally, I think it's even less than a half of what the MCAT actually is trying to get you to do.
100%.
And so the more you do questions, the more you start recognizing, oh, this is how they're trying to test me. Let me start changing my mindset about how this is. Again, MCAT is not regurgitation. Like there's very, very little, if any, questions that will ask you to, I don't know, identify an amino acid from a particular group, right? They'll always want you to know the properties of this amino acid and how, if it replaced another amino acid, how would that change the function of the protein? Something like that, right? So you're always taking that extra step. And the best way to get at that is to do more questions. And as you were saying, we always tell people quality over quantity. So it's not like do 5,000 questions and you never learn from them. It's like you do questions, a set of questions, and you say, okay, why did I get some of these wrong? Like, where did my thinking go wrong here? And so, and then based off of your analysis, building off of that, and then revising the way you're studying to do better, hopefully.
Yeah. So I want to go back to your story a little bit. You mentioned preparing for the MCAT the first time in like 2016 or so. Did you end up taking it then or no?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I mean, some people were telling me, take it, you know, you just give it a try. I ultimately ended up not deciding not to, because I just knew that whatever score I was going to get wasn't going to be great. Because, you know, I wasn't scoring where I wanted to score. And then I knew that it would possibly even put me down further. So I actually ended up not taking it. And I'm grateful that I didn't, because I think that would have added more to my like anxiety of coming back. Or maybe it could have helped. I don't know. But I ended up not taking it. And but some people do. Some people, even though they know they're not ready, they're like, you know what? I just want to see how it is. And that's totally fine as well. I've known people who did that. And they end up retaking it, but it's sort of like they break the ice by taking the first time around.
Yeah. So second time around comes, you're feeling better. You're cruising along. When you took your test, did you know you did well? Like, you're like, oh yeah, I crushed that. I'm good.
Yeah. I don't know if I like felt like, oh, I crushed it, but I felt comfortable. Okay. You know, I the night, it was really interesting, because I always thought like when it came to the MCAT, like I would never feel ready. And I think like that's something that a lot of people struggle with. They're like, oh, I could have studied more. We always tell students, you're always going to find a way to have said, I could have studied more. But for me, what I felt, which I really liked, was the night before the exam, I was like, you know what? I did the best that I could with the time that I had and the capability that I had. And I was very grateful for that mindset, because I think the next day when I entered, I didn't come from this point of like, you're horrible, you didn't work hard enough. It was kind of like, you know what? I did what I could do.
Yeah.
And however it turns out. And when I left the exam, I felt comfortable. You know, like, for example, the bio section was harder than I thought it would be, which was really interesting, because bio, and this is why I always tell people, you never know what the MCAT on the day of is going to show up.
Yeah.
But the bio section was, in my practice exams, was either the highest or the second highest section consistently. It actually ended up being my lowest scoring section, which I thought it was funny.
Wow.
And so you don't know, right? And so, but, you know, I felt comfortable. I was like, you know, I don't feel horrible. And I was okay. And then I was just grateful that it was done.
Like, so much relief.
Like, just like, I was like, it doesn't even matter. I'm just so happy this is done. Like, and that's kind of how I approach med school exams now. I'm like, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen, but it's just done, you know? So, like I said, everybody I know works very, very hard, and people are so tough on themselves. And I would say, try your best to enter the exam with the mindset that you really did try the best you could. You know, some people have so much time to prep, and others, they have so many other responsibilities, you know, like, not everybody has a lot of time to prep or the resources. So always try to give yourself some grace.
Yeah, Grace is important. Be kind to yourselves, my friends. Let's talk about the application cycle. As a non-traditional student, you had kind of gone off and explored other things. Did you feel like you had to explain that in your application to go, like, I really am serious about being a doctor. I know I stepped away for a little bit, but you're the one I love.
I actually think that being a non-trad is actually makes you non-trad is just short for non-traditional, because sometimes their physicians are like, what does non-trad mean? And yeah. I was like, oh, okay. This is a new concept to you because you didn't take this. I actually think it makes you a stronger applicant, mm-hmm. because I think what admissions committees recognize is that you didn't just make this decision because it was just like the straight line path. Like, there was something clearly that pushed you to come back, or not come back, but like consider this, right? And I think though that it's important when you're writing your personal statement to highlight the turning point, right? Like, to highlight, why is it that I am choosing to come back or to go into medicine, or for me, in my case, it was to come back to medicine. But I think people do a really great job because, you know, they're like, yeah, over time I realized, you know, this was the impact that I wanted to make. Or maybe they had like a very important point at which they realized it was something that was going to make a difference in their lives and other lives. And so for me, like I said, I don't necessarily think I had like one aha moment when I talked about it in my personal statement. I talked about how it was a long period of reflection over different like global health and public health research projects. And at each of those identifying, I think I talked about like three or four identifying, like, this is why going into medicine makes sense, right? Because it's like, you know, this project, I reflected on the role that physicians play in this particular part of, you know, public health. Like, one of them, for example, I worked on domestic violence in Brazil. And I was like, physicians play a very, very important role when it comes to their recognition of victims of violence, as well as connecting them to resources. And then I talked about doing Arab American health research and how I really want to become an advocate for Arab American health, which is a big population in the United States, and it's growing. And so for me, it was like showing them that I have always reflected on each of my experiences, and that has ultimately led me to realize that my role as an advocate was going to be as a physician. Mm-hmm. It was no longer as a researcher. It was going to be as a physician. And I personally think that made my application stronger. And I always tell people, I didn't have the highest GPA. I'm not saying I had a low GPA, but it's funny because people think like, oh, you go to Stanford, you must have had a 4.0. I was like, no, I did not. or I don't care to tell people that I didn't, because I struggled in undergrad because I didn't realize I had ADHD. So I was struggling with like learning and not doing maybe as best as I could, even though I know I'm smart, because I was struggling with like this new thing that was coming up that I didn't know how to I didn't even know was a problem. And so I always tell people, like, it wasn't, you know, even if I didn't get the highest GPA, it doesn't mean that I wasn't set up for medical school. It meant just that people were not recognizing, or that somebody wasn't recognizing, myself and others, that I needed to change the way that I was studying, and I needed extra accommodations or something like that. So, but I think that having that non-traditional experience made my application stronger, because they were like, well, clearly this person can work and study hard, right? And I think like I was very grateful that I scored a 519 on the MCAT, because I think it also showed them, oh, okay, this person can come back to this material 6 years after they learned it, yeah. and still like relearn it and, you know, take an exam on it. So, and do well, thankfully. And so for me, I think ultimately I just had so much more to talk about. Like, yeah. my interviews were so much more interesting.
Yep, 100%.
So much fun. Like, it sounds very pretentious to people, but I actually didn't prep for my med school interviews because I had already done so many job interviews before. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, this just feels like another job interview. I had some questions. You know, I looked at the school's website. I became acclimated, but I didn't really do that much prep because I was like, well, I've applied for a lot of jobs, and this is a job. This is another position that I'm going into, and I had so much to draw upon, and it made for a really interesting conversation.
Yeah,
really, really exciting. Yeah,
love it. What was it like to get your first medical school acceptance? Oh.
I cried my eyes out. It was Washington University, St. Louis. They gave me a call and I was just crying. And I was like, I'm so sorry. And she was like, no, it's okay. This, like, makes me so happy to do this. Like, it always makes my day. And it was so validating. And it was, yeah, it just, Stanford was actually my last acceptance. And so, but that's funny. I was in on a road trip with some of my girlfriends. We were going to Zion National Park, and I get the call, and they tell me that I got accepted, and then we all simultaneously scream, and I accidentally hang up the phone, and then I have to call back, and it was just really funny, and just like we had this video of all of us screaming our heads off, which is really great. But it really is, regardless of where you get accepted, it really, like, that first acceptance is just magical.
Yeah,
because you're like, it doesn't matter where I end up now, I'm going to become a physician.
It's, yeah,
really awesome.
I want a picture kind of behind the scenes, the whoever's calling, whether it's the dean or director of admissions or someone. Yeah. Like, hey, I'm about to call Noor. I bet you she's a crier. Calls you up. She's crying. Give me my money. they got odds.
Yeah. They always say that it's their favorite part of the job.
Oh, yeah.
Have like a whole gambit of like people's reactions.
Yeah.
And what that is. Yeah,
that's fun. Yes. Why did you become an MCAT instructor?
Oh my god, that is, I always tell people that was the most unexpected thing of my life. I went from like the MCAT being like the scariest thing of my life to becoming an MCAT instructor, because I just really want to help people get away from that anxiety. Like, I just really don't think the MCAT should be the reason why people don't become physicians. Like, I would love to see a world in which we assess people's capabilities in a different way than the MCAT, but this is where we exist now. And I think that, I don't think the MCAT is a determiner of how well a physician somebody's going to be. Like, 100%. There are people who didn't do amazing on the MCAT, and they're incredible and kind and wonderful physicians who work very hard. They do well in medical school and they go on to do really well as physicians. And so I don't want this to be the hurdle that stops people, especially people from low and middle income communities who can't afford the resources to maybe push them to do even better, for them not to go into medicine. And so, and also sometimes people just have a lot of anxiety. And I'm very, like, grateful to be able to always share my story with people and also tell them, like, when I was studying for the MCAT and I took exams, I got score plateaus and I really struggled with this subject. And so being an instructor and hopefully being able to model to people, like, I was really once in your shoes and I want to help you get out of that rut, is very rewarding. Like, it is really, really rewarding to be able to see people to do really well. And when my students tell me that they scored really well, it almost feels sweeter than me getting my own score back, because you're like, wow, like, this just feels awesome to have taken away this hurdle from someone or just helped them overcome it. So it's really great. It's very, very rewarding, actually.
Yeah. How can students, if they want to work with you with MCAT prep, how can they work with you with Blueprint?
Yeah, so I'm a live online instructor. I don't have any classes for this summer, but I've taught a few so far. And so if you go on to the live, like Blueprint MCAT live online instruction, and they're different classes, then you can see, like, you know, upcoming classes, instructors. And even if you don't end up working with me, honestly, all of our instructors are amazing. And I know you're thinking, oh, maybe she's just selling for the company. No, I mean, everybody is super awesome, super enthusiastic, really invested in helping people. I mean, they're just wonderful. And that's actually, like, I tell people that my two instructors that I had, they were so awesome. And one of them actually is a second year med student at Stanford. So it's this amazing full circle that ended up coming back to being able to go to school with my instructor, who is, she's younger than me, but like also super wise. Like it's really amazing. But the instructors have such a positive attitude that I was excited to go to class because I was like, oh, okay, like the MCAT is so dreadful, but they're so cheerful and so energetic that it made me feel less dreadful about the MCAT. And so I think a lot of instructors have such a positive attitude, and that makes a huge difference. Like if you're instructor is enthusiastic. Like I compare it to like when you go to an exercise class and your instructor has like good music and like good energy. Like you want 100%. To come back. Yep. You're like, this is a good time. This is fun. It makes me feel great. And so even if you don't end up working with me, I mean, all of our instructors are so awesome. They really are. And you can see, by the way, I always tell people, look at the reviews. That's the most important part. Just look at the reviews and you'll see that a lot of people just really love class time. And even if they feel down about the MCAT, I have students being like, I still came to class because this is sometimes the only time in the week where I feel like I can get more encouragement. And I feel like that encouragement is refilled. And that's wonderful. So, but yeah, Blueprint MCAT online live instruction.
Love it. Yeah. Nor for the student listening to this on their journey, maybe struggling, maybe a new diagnosis of ADHD, whatever it is, but potentially doubting themselves as they go through this journey. What final words of wisdom do you have for them?
Yeah, the MCAT doesn't define your life. It doesn't. And failure also doesn't define your life. It just opens other doors. I failed so much. I've gotten Fs on exams. I've done terrible on MCAT practice. There's so many moments where I failed, and I think those are the moments that made me actually become a stronger person, more determined. And so just please don't let one moment or one exam or one hurdle define your future, because that's not true. And that's not fair to all of the hard work that you've put in. And so always remember, everything that you've done so far that's been incredible, and not just like that one thing that's like sticking out. That's what we humans like to do. We focus on one thing.
The one thing.
And then we just totally discount everything else, which is very, very sad. And I always tell that to my students, like, do not do that, please. You've already done such amazing things, and those are just as important as one class or one exam or anything.
All right, so there you have it. Thanks for joining us here on the pre-mid years. I hope you took some awesome stuff from Nora and her story today. And if you are looking for some one-on-one advising, or maybe you want to check out our Application Academy, you can do so over at medicalschoolhq.net to check out our advising services. We do interview prep, essay editing. We'll walk you through the whole application cycle, walk with you through the whole application cycle together through our application cycle prep. Whatever you need to get into medical school and soon into residency, because we're going to start offering those services with our new amazing advisor on our team, Carlos Tapia, who is just the director of student affairs over at Mount Sinai, helping the Mount Sinai students apply to residencies. We're going to start doing that as well. Anyway, I hope you have a wonderful week. We'll see you next time here on the Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.